You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
Today is the 47th anniversary of the killing of George Jackson, an organizer inside San Quentin Prison who died during an attempted escape. And marking today's anniversary, prisoners in at least 17 states across the country are launching a coordinated strike whose demands include improvements to conditions inside prisons, prevailing wages for prison work, increased access to rehabilitation services and legal appeals, as well as broad reforms to the way that this country determines sentencing, parole, and treatment of people once they are inside the system. The final demand, voting rights for people who've been convicted of felonies. We're joined in studio by one of the people who is helping to coordinate that strike from the outside. Brooke Terpstra is an organizer with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or IWOC. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you start off by telling the origin story of the strike? How did this get started?
I'll give you the big arc that there's a prisoner movement rising in this country. It's been rising for 10 years. It's its own entity. It's independent. It's politicizing. And it has its roots in the South. Georgia saw work stoppages in 2010. California's example of hunger strikes in 2011-13 followed. On the heel of Georgia, four other states immediately had work stoppages. 2014 saw an increase in the tempo of coordinated actions across different prisons. 2016 saw another uprising across different prisons in Alabama, Texas, which the IWW and IWOC had a hand in helping coordinate and support. Saw coordinated work stoppages across a number of facilities. And on the strength of that participation and collaboration inside and outside, IWOC was connected to the Southern movements.
And IWOC is?
Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. The 2016 strike was called. On the heels of that, there's been an increased tempo of strikes, work stoppages, coordinated protest. It's a distinct change in tactic from previous prisoner uprisings, which were uncoordinated or spontaneous, often taking the form of riots or simply property destruction that didn't have a level of coordination and like intention behind them. So we have a politicized and strategic prisoner movement rising in this country that's now has 8 years of legacy behind it. This brings us to this state. The period of 2017 saw a period of like strategizing on the lessons of 2016 to take those in to see what steps were next. It was resolved that outside support needed to grow, that inside-outside relationships needed to grow. And at the beginning of the year, they had decided this loose confederation of different prisoner groups within the South and other states that had participated in 2016 especially, that the time wasn't right for a strike in 2018. Then Lee Correctional Institution happened. The riot, so-called riot, at Lee in South Carolina on April 15th. Now that was
an incident that saw seven inmates killed.
Yes, absolutely. It was a complete atrocity. It was set up by the state. And even though the knives and weapons were held by rival factions within the dormitories, the conditions and the way that violence is stoked inside is a tool of prison administrations. This is some prison 101, that prisoners are not the fountain of violence according to the, basically mainstream, mythology about what prison life is. States intentionally stoke violence between inmates in order to maintain control over the populations in there. They did it in South Carolina with very intentionally brutalizing prisoners with conditions within very intentional, what they call mix and match transfers, where they house people, they sell you up with rival sets intentionally. Instead of letting one group basically live in peace in a dormitory, they'll intentionally stir, fights in between inmates, because that basically puts leverage within the guards and the administration's hands. They did this constantly in South Carolina. They also completely took away all lockers, so there's no means by which to secure your belongings, which drove thieving through the roof, which drove beef and conflict between prisoners through the roof. And prison fights typically last like 5 minutes, a couple minutes, 15 minutes is a marathon. This was allowed to roll for more than 7 hours from one dormitory to the next. They would fight to exhaustion. Prisoners that wanted to opt out of the fight could not lock themselves safely in their cell because the locks are broken, that conditions are so badly maintained in that state. They could not sequester themselves from the conflict going on. Prisoners would take their cellmates and their brothers to the gate as they were stabbed and bleeding, hoping that at least at the gate they might be able to get medical attention. Guards on the other side watched them bleed out on the floor. That's what caused seven brothers to die. So in the wake of this, the prisoners movement inside essentially reconvened. Many of them are from facilities exactly like this who have lived through events like this and faced this kind of level of manipulation and setup and basically threat to their survival, not just conditions, but basically life itself. They could not let it stand. The time for action was now, so they pushed up the date for the strike to 2018 and issued a press release on April 23rd.
Can you kind of walk me through the theory of power here? When prisoners withhold their labor, who winds up getting hurt? How does that create political leverage?
The primary beneficiary of prison labor is the prison system itself. There is work that goes on for correctional industries. There is work that goes on for, like, correctional industries are the state-run production facilities or industries that produce goods for the state. Basically, all the furniture you see in libraries or at a university is probably made by a prisoner. There are also some outside vendors that employ prisoners, but it's minute. It's essentially 3%, you know, total within incarcerated people, you know, even including pretrial detainees. Only 3% of that massive total work for those kind of industries. The mass of prisoners, like nearly 500,000 of the 2.3 that are locked up, are maintaining the prison itself. Mass incarceration, this industrial scale of brutalization and warehousing, would not be possible whatsoever without the coerced, you know, labor of prisoners themselves.
Meaning they're doing building maintenance, working in the cafeteria,
everything.
Doing laundry.
Clerical, mowing the lawn, doing the laundry, making the food, all the reproductive labor, including even clerical. There are now prisoners, what's called privilege yards. That's another thing we could get into possibly, and it's how prison administrations are basically splitting the prisoner population between a privileged set that basically cooperates with the state and has a certain kind of security profile that's allowed to basically be a gang boss on other prisoners. So they're actually outsourcing various low levels of administration to prisoners themselves like trustees. I mean, that's the level of prisoner integration in terms of the management and maintenance of the facility.
Speaking of Brooke Terpstra, he's an organizer with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. One of the organizations is doing outside support for a coordinated prisoner strike that is starting today, scheduled to run through September 9th, the anniversary of the Attica uprising, and ostensibly taking place in 17 states. What can you tell us about the facilities in California that will be participating?
I can tell you a little. I can't tell you all, simply because of repression. Repression is already started. It's been months in the making. Prisoners are preemptively locked down at the slightest hint of any action. So I can tell you that there are a number of facilities that we've gotten confirmation that there'll be strike activity within, but I can't tell you which ones. I can tell you it's more than one and less than all of them.
And what kind of participation rates within those prisons that are participating?
That's a complete mystery. Essentially, the prisoners' movement parallels the outside in terms of it might affect a great number of prisoners. There might be a lot of sympathetic, but in terms of the most active and prisoners that organize, it's very similar to the outside in the way that a small slice of the folks most invested will put in a lot of labor and commitment into it. And there are certain, slice of the population that will join in once it reaches a certain level. We simply don't know. You know, but it's this couple weeks is going to tell us a lot. It's going to take a while for us to get back any of the data, any of the confirmation of what's going on, or even numbers, due to the fact that there's a complete denial that it's happening by prison systems, and especially CDCR admits next to none of the time when there's actual protests going on inside of its facilities.
CDCR is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. They run our prisons in the state.
Exactly.
Can you walk us through what it would look like within a prison? So today the strike starts. Let's imagine a prison where a strike is taking place. What does it look like inside? What does it look like for the individual striker?
I'll give you two examples on the opposite ends of the spectrum. One example from 2016 in Holman facility in Alabama, which was a stronghold of the organizing for the strike in 2016, essentially saw people get up and complete quiet and calm. Whole dormitories just went about their business. The Muslim Brothers went about their prayers. Folks did their laundry, and no one reported for work. No one prepared the food. People ate out of their commissary, and it was complete calm. And except that, except none of the outside the dormitories was complete bewilderment. they had nothing to do. They had simply stood there, you know, went about their tasks, and wondered how they could crush this. On the other end of the facility, like on the end of the spectrum of what strike activity could look like, are a prisoner in solitary. Simply goes on hunger strike, starts refusing food. If they have access to communication, particularly through a lawyer, they might issue a statement. They'll have to refuse food for at least 72 hours before the system will recognize it as a hunger strike, and then basically a protocol for medical checks and wellness. You know, some states will then, you know, start trying to force feed you and basically take away your agency over your own body. So those are two quite extreme, you know, the far from you. That's the basically the breadth of what it could look like. Right now, I'm in contact with a California prisoner, indigent, so he has no money to basically withdraw from the system in terms of a boycott of not buying commissary, which is one of the proposed actions. He's in a wheelchair, so he has no job. So he's going to refuse movements and has declared his support for the strike, and refuse programming, or possibly even go on hunger strike because that's all he has left.
How do the prisoners themselves coordinate between facilities?
Well, if people that have been locked up don't need to ask this question, because word travels within prisons pretty quickly, despite all the intentions and all the technology deployed. Within facilities, kites, which are notes that are shot from one cell to another, the way trustees and information is passed, the way contraband economies are set up inside, also traffic in information. And these contraband economies, we should say, are essentially controlled by the guards. So the guards, by maintaining a massive contraband economy and running it, actually enable the flow of information, not to mention the flow of cell phones. You know, a cell phone in Louisiana is going right now for about $200. California runs about $2,500. So there's a big change there. I mean, California, it's harder to get a hold of those things.
Everything's pricier in California.
except that CDCR... It is a special case. CDCR is an experimenter and like the leader in terms of developing isolation and control. So it's a very specialized and a riskier contraband economy, you know, for guards. And any study that's worth anything, there's a whole field called penology and criminology. The studies within this academic discipline, any of these studies basically put the number at 80% of all contraband material is controlled and like moved by guards, and the economy as a whole inside is basically controlled by guards, if not like directly, you know, involved.
But then, so are prisoners at different facilities able to be in direct contact with each other, like say over contraband cell phones, or do they rely on outside organizations, intermediaries, or just kind of broadcasting their intentions and hoping others join the bandwagon?
All of the above. All of the above, with the addition of transfers. Transfers are a go-to tactic for repression. When prisoners develop a group or successfully protest or have an action, or even develop a certain familiarity and truce and agreement amongst themselves, the prison system will transfer people immediately in order to break up that conviviality and power that inmates have developed amongst each other. Except that once prisoners successfully and collectively act, they have that within them. They have that memory. They have that knowledge. And they also have that familiarity. So when they get transferred, you're essentially sending an apostle of the movement to the next facility. So some systems are running into the wall of not having enough facilities or enough distance or a big enough system, because it's state-defined for the most part, unless it's federal, and federal prisons are involved in the strike, that they don't have the ability to actually sequester or punish inmates any longer in this way. Transfers aren't as viable. Because within, like, for say, Missouri, where this was recently undertaken, prisoners at one uprising were transferred after being locked down in solitary for about 2 months. They couldn't transfer them right immediately because they knew as soon as they sent them to another facility, they would be organizers of the next uprising and take word of the movement there. Hmm. So California is unique in the way it has a massive system with a massive capacity for solitary. So in California, kind of stands out as a uniquely strong repressive apparatus, even just in terms of its geography. They can transfer you, one facility to the other, 1,000 miles from Pelican Bay to Sentinella. I think it's 951 miles on Google Maps.
We're talking with Brooke Tepstra. He's the organizer for the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee about the National Prisoner Strike taking place today. Can you talk about the demands of the strike?
Yeah. There are 10 demands. They were formed. Initially, there was a large, you know, pool of demands, and they whittled them down to 10. It was a matter of negotiation between different groupings, which all had different kind of levels of consciousness or politics or aims. And you can see it within the document that they're essentially the product of a coalition. They span from demand number 10, they want the right to vote to be counted, all the way up to a broad demand, like we demand to be recognized as human beings, number one, and everything in between, including, you know, an end to racist gang enhancement laws that are an extra tool that the state basically grants itself to demonize and lock people away on basically a white supremacist logic. To repeal the, you know, Litigation Reform Act, which stripped prisoners in the early 90s of the ability to litigate on their own behalf effectively. They changed the fee structure and the way that access was oriented for prisoners to be able to use it. They basically stripped away every avenue that was available there and make them, even just the filing fee for something, you know, prohibits a prisoner from litigating on their own behalf. To work for $6 and, you know, 6 cents an hour and to have to file a $300 filing fee with a federal court is an immense hurdle to overcome. So it effectively legislates against the poor representing themselves within courts. They want to be paid for their labor. They want to be recognized. At the core of all these demands is essentially a bid for their humanity. And some of them see voting as one of the aspects of humanity and basically civil life. They've been doomed to a social death, a complete lack of recognition of humanity. You know, notably also the white prisoners, you know, inside have been, like, sentenced to a state of social death. And that all these aspects are essentially, you know, aspects of humanity that you're granted on the outside. Or at least you should be, at least. We're finding out a lot of people push back on the demands because they're jealous. Because out people in the free world that don't get it, that never been locked up, look at these demands and say, we don't even get this on the outside. Mm. You know, I barely have the right to vote. And I don't have support for rehabilitation. And I don't have access to education. And so basically the prisoners' demands are a profound document in the way that they're exposing the social contract as a profound lie and profoundly, like, non-existent.
All right. Brooke Terpstra, before we let you go, for people who want to track developments in the strike, what's the best way to stay informed?
We have a portal site that links to events, resources, and all the pages, including IWOC's informational pages, including the official support pages from the JLS, Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, which is the facilitating inside core leadership. They have their own archive pages set up. Also for actions, for anti-repression actions, phone actions where we shut down prison offices, follow IWOC's Twitter at IWW underscore IWOC.
Okay, IWW underscore IWOC, or you can Google search for Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Brooke Terpstra, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Brooke Terpstra is an organizer with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. They're doing outside support for a 2.5 week long nationally coordinated prisoner strike that begins today. The anniversary of the killing of George Jackson runs through August 9th, the anniversary of the Attica uprising.